Good evening and welcome behind the news for July 1st, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Because of a technical glitch, portions of this show were lost to the ages, namely the first 7 to 8 minutes, during which I went over the news headlines and introduced the first interview segment. Fortunately, that interview was pre-recorded, so I can just drop it into this archive file. But also lost for the first minute or two of the second interview segment, which was broadcast live. But it was only a minute or two, so almost all of that segment was preserved for all time. There are two interviews up for tonight, the first with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies on the human, economic, social, and environmental costs of the war with Iraq, and the second with the authors of a new book called Citizen U, a patriotic handbook telling us ordinary citizens what we can do to help keep America secure and free. If the first few minutes of the show hadn't been lost, you would have heard me talking about the Fed's move to raise the interest rate under its direct control, the so-called federal funds rate, by a quarter point, its first tightening in 4 years. And you would have heard me talk about the new regime of openness at the Fed. This move was telegraphed for weeks in advance and announced with a press release immediately after the meeting. Time was when highly paid Fed watchers would scrutinize the central bank's every move for clues as to what it was about to do or even what policy changes it had just made. No more. For the last several years, the Fed has been very clear about what it's going to do and what it has done. The Fed has kept short-term rates low for a very long time to help revive the U.S. economy after the breaking of the late 1990s bubble. That long period of indulgence is now over, but it's unlikely that they're going to raise rates dramatically or suddenly. There's still too much potential vulnerability in the economy to higher rates because households and businesses have been borrowing heavily and financiers have been conducting experiments in risk and leverage we still don't understand and might not until something breaks. So I think the Fed will, as its press release said, take a measured approach. There are some on Wall Street who think the Fed is behind the curve in fighting inflation, but Greenspan isn't likely to listen to them unless something changes dramatically. For more, watch this space in the coming weeks and months. Had the opening segment not been lost, you would have also heard me talking about some recent economic releases showing the U.S. economy is still recovering, but not with stunning vigor, the Western European job market still acting weak, but the Japanese economy seeming to extend its recovery. And finally, for this opening segment, you would have heard me introduce this interview with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and lead author of Paying the Price, a study of the human, economic, social, and environmental costs of the war in Iraq. The full report is available at the IPS website, ips-dc.org. Phyllis Bennis. The war has many, many costs, many, many definitions. Cost to the U.S., cost to Iraq, cost to the rest of the world. So let's do a survey of the field. First of all, what are the costs that you identify to the United States? Let's talk in human terms first before we get to the money.
Well, the talk in human terms has been enormous. We're approaching 900 U.S. troops that have been killed so far. There are thousands of U.S. troops that have been injured, some of them with grievous injuries, the kind that never survived before because of new advances in technology, medical technology. They're surviving with multiple amputations, blinding, a range of horrific physical challenges that are going to absolutely transform people's lives. And we know that at least 20% of the soldiers coming back are also facing serious emotional disorders, the possibility of post-traumatic stress syndrome in most of them. So this war has been very, very costly in human terms.
And what the cost to Iraqis are, I presume, even greater. So what do those look like?
Well, the cost to Iraqis, just in the numbers killed, is 10 times the numbers of U.S. and even U.S. coalition troops that have been killed. It's very, very difficult because the Pentagon makes it a point of principle not to get, not to track Iraqi casualties. But a group of British academics at Iraq Body Count have been monitoring all of the international press that they can get a hold of to try and come up with the most reliable estimates. And the numbers that we have range from a low of 9,436 to a high of 11,317 as of last week.
You also cite security costs to the United States. What do you mean by those?
Well, essentially what we were looking at here when we tried to look at the costs of war was to put it in the context of what have we gained. What we hear constantly is, well, whatever the cost, Americans are safer. The reality is Americans are not safer. The threat of terrorism has not gone away. Quite the contrary, the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies was asked what is the effect of the war in Iraq on al-Qaeda, and their answer was in two words, accelerated recruitment. So what we have done with this war has been to transform Iraq into something it never was before, which is a centerpiece of global terrorism, a gathering point, if you will, for global terrorism. So Americans simply are not any safer. State Department itself, after grudgingly acknowledging that they lied in the early editions of their annual Patterns of Global Terrorism report, amended the report to tell the truth, at least what we think is now the truth, indicating that global terrorism has significantly skyrocketed this year. So it's simply a lie to say that this war has made Americans or anyone else in the world safer.
And it looks like the polls are finally coming around to that point of view, too, at least the polls of the American public.
Starting to, at least.
Yeah. What about the economic costs? How much is this war costing the U.S. Direct and indirectly?
Well, so far, the money that's being spent on this war comes to $151 billion this year. One of the problems we have, of course, is that it's impossible to kind of grasp what that number means. Nobody's ever seen $151 billion anything. So it's hard, I think, for all of us to imagine just how much money that really is. What we did in this report was to compare it to what else could be done with $151 billion. And if we look at the domestic side, that could include paying for housing vouchers for 23 million Americans who are currently homeless. It could pay for health care for 27 million uninsured Americans. It could pay the salary for 3 million elementary school teachers who have either lost their jobs or never were hired because of insufficient money in the schools. So it's a huge amount of money. If we look at it on the global level, the impact is even more dramatic. At the global level, we're not talking about a choice between these various things as we are on the domestic side, but rather all of them. For $151 billion, we could feed half the hungry people in the entire world for 2 years, provide water and sanitation to everyone in the developing countries that don't currently have it for 2 years, provide a comprehensive global AIDS program for 2 years, and immunize every child in the developing world for 2 years. That's an extraordinary level of global involvement that could do more, in my view, to prevent future terrorism than anything that we might be doing in the war in Iraq.
You're citing costs that have been allocated and spent, but it looks like we have some costs in the future, too. What do those look like?
Well, the military estimates that the U.S. occupation of Iraq will go on at least 3 years. Now, many people believe it will be much longer than that, not least because the Pentagon has built 14 what they are calling permanent bases in Iraq. It's not very likely that they're going to be abandoned anytime soon. But we use the three-year figure that the military has asserted, and what we find is that the estimated long-term cost of war to every household over that three-year period would be about $3,415. And that's an extraordinary amount of money. I think it was your work that was part of coming up with that figure, a very crucial one, because it goes directly to the question of what are people getting for their taxes? You know, this is an extraordinary moment when, along with going to war, a war that was opposed by the rest of the world, opposed by a huge proportion of the American people, this administration has done something that no American administration has ever done before when it went to war. In the past, anytime you go to war, wars cost a lot of money, taxes were raised. This time around, taxes have been cut and cut and cut over again, particularly for the rich. So all of this money is coming out of deficit spending. leaving a legacy of paying for this war to probably the next three generations of our children.
And if we look back at the first Gulf War, a phenomenal percentage of the veterans are in some sort of disability, from moderate to full. One can only guess that this war, being more protracted and severe, would produce even more disasters in the future. What does that look like? What's the cost of veterans going to be?
Well, what we know is that the Bush administration, among other things, is trying to cut the payments for veterans' health care. We know that the average waiting time for a veteran returning from Iraq today to get fully into the Veterans Administration system for their full health care, not necessarily the wait to see a doctor on an emergency level or something, but to really get into the system, is 170 days. And not surprisingly, given that the military has instituted a host of arrangements to expand the force without a legal draft, relying solely on the poverty draft that has brought about the so-called all-volunteer army, they've done things like instituting the stop-loss rules that allow the president essentially to invalidate the contracts signed by everybody who joins this supposedly volunteer army. What it says is that the president can, whenever he chooses, impose a rule that no one in the military can leave, even if their contract is up. They're not obligated anymore, but they have to stay anyway. We just heard in the last couple of days that more than 5,000 former members of the military who did not join the reserve at all when they left, they chose to get out altogether, they are suddenly being involuntarily picked up to go serve in Iraq. As a result of all of this, according to U.S. military figures themselves, the percentage of soldiers who say that they are facing low morale in Iraq is 52%, and half of all the soldiers have said they will not reenlist. So we're facing a serious challenge to our soldiers who are being forced to fight a war that does not have popular support, that is not legal, and for whom the ultimate price is so often being paid.
And to return to the some costs to Iraq, of course, there are longer-term costs that will be felt in the future, such as depleted uranium. How severe is that problem?
This is a very severe problem. What we know is that there has been already three times the amount of depleted uranium dropped in this war as there was in the Gulf War of 1991. That time around, there was about 300 tons of depleted uranium used in Iraq. This time around, it's already over 1,000 tons. And depleted uranium, of course, is a highly toxic substance. It can seep into the groundwater. It can seep into, ultimately, the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates River. The Tigris River, of course, flows down into the Shatt al-Arab, which meets Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Iran. And these are, you know, all of these countries face the possibility of being contaminated, as well as the contamination that's affecting Iraqi civilians already, children in particular. If we look at the effect in places in Iraq from the last war, from 10 years ago, the areas where depleted uranium use was the heaviest, particularly in the south, the childhood cancer rates, childhood leukemias and a few other kinds of cancers, have skyrocketed in the years since then. And although there's no absolutely definitive study yet, largely because the Pentagon refuses to allow such a study on the impact of depleted uranium, it's believed, and there's massive anecdotal evidence among the medical people in Iraq, that depleted uranium is the preeminent, although probably not the sole, cause of that rise in cancer rates.
I'm speaking with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies about the various costs of the Iraq War. The Bush administration claims that, for whatever the problems, the U.S. has done Iraqis a great favor by removing the admittedly unpleasant Saddam Hussein from power. But what about the effect on day-to-day life of Iraqis? Is their life better than it was a couple of years ago, and do they feel grateful for their alleged liberation?
Well, I have no doubt that most Iraqis are very pleased to have that terrible regime out of the way, no longer in power. It was tremendously repressive and corrupt. That being said, in an even more recent poll that came out actually after our report was drafted just in the last few days, There are indications that less than half of Iraqis believe that life is better today than before the war. That's extraordinary, given that before the war you not only had Saddam Hussein still in power, but you had the impact of devastating economic sanctions that had really shredded the economic and social life of the country. So, you know, we're dealing with a situation in which Iraqis themselves are saying they don't feel that their lives are better off. There is another poll from a month ago taken by the U.S. occupation authorities that indicated that 55% of Iraqis do not feel safe and will feel safer when every U.S. soldier is gone from their country. Now, that's an astonishing statistic, given the claims that all of the other bases for the war have proved to be lies. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no operative link between Iraq and al-Qaeda. There was no uranium yellow cake, et cetera, et cetera. Given that everything else has collapsed, the only rationale the administration is now counting on is this question of, well, at least we brought democracy to Iraq. Well, unfortunately, the Iraqis don't seem to think so. And despite the indications that people are prepared to give this new, ostensibly but not really, sovereign government a chance, because frankly, what other alternative do people have, it's clear that people do not accept the U.S. occupation as something that has improved their lives.
What do you make of the premature handover?
Well, it's an indication of failure. It's as good as anything else to prove the level of failure. On the one hand, there were clearly security concerns. The escalation in violence over the last few weeks made it very clear that June 30th was going to be a day of massive violence. So partly they were afraid. So they have this furtive ceremony with nobody allowed to come. The few reporters that are hand-picked and brought in are stripped of their cell phones, not allowed to call out, not allowed to tell anybody. So that was clearly part of it. The other part of it is pure opportunism. It happened to be the same time as the NATO summit in Istanbul. And what better photo op for Bush in his ongoing effort to persuade his allies that somehow, even though they were all opposed to the war, that they now have the obligation to be in favor of the occupation? What better way to do that than to show that, you see, we said that we were going to turn over sovereignty, and now we've done it. So it had nothing to do, in my view, with turning over real sovereignty to the Iraqis. It had everything to do with a photo op.
You also read about human rights costs. What do you mean by that?
Well, on the global level, even before we talk about the human rights crisis inside Iraq, in the prisons of Abu Ghraib and in other instances, on a global level, what this war has led to has been a classic new example, where now every country in the world that might on a rare occasion be criticized by the U.S. for human rights violations can say, and many already have said, that why should we abide by human rights norms, by human rights conventions, when you don't, when you have said in your internal memos within your administration that your administration is not bound by the Geneva Conventions, why should we be? On the other hand, we know that the U.S. administration has already made decisions on such things as giving military dictators like Pervez Musharraf in Pakistan an explicit pass on human rights accusations because they are seen as an ally in the so-called war against terrorism. So the undermining of human rights norms around the world has become very serious. Then if we look in Iraq, the impact is even more dramatic. I think everybody is familiar with the issues of torture in the prisons. But I think we also should keep in mind the broader definitions of human rights. When an occupying power takes over, it is obligated to provide for all of the humanitarian needs of the occupied population. Those, too, are human rights, economic and social rights. And the failure of the United States to provide sufficient clean water, sufficient electricity, even sufficient food in many cases, is the obligation of an occupying power. The fact that there are problems in doing that, the fact that there are attacks on the oil pipelines or whatever, does not give the U.S. a pass. They are still obligated and they are still violating those human rights. Then we have, of course, the question of the impact of the war on human rights at home, and that's where we've seen it in quite a dramatic way, with the closure of access to free speech, the closure of the rights to assemble, with many demonstrations being shut down, as well as the broader continuing attacks on the civil rights and human rights of immigrant communities, particularly Arabs and Muslims in the U.S., who are continuously facing, paying a huge price for the domestic impact of this war, with deportations, people being held without, not only without bail, but without being able to notify lawyers, without being able to be in touch with their family. The disappeared of Argentina's dirty war of the 1970s has come home to the United States.
And finally, you spent many years observing the UN. Certainly the UN has been criticized either for being ineffectual or for being a front for the big powers, but how serious is the damage to that body and you know, the processes of international diplomacy in general, and how much should we care about it?
Well, I think we should care about it a lot. The damage has been extraordinary. We came through an eight-month period where, in my view, the UN was more relevant, more important, more useful, more valuable, more a part of the global community than ever before, when it stood defiant of the U.S. drive towards war. From September of 2002 until May of 2003, when the Security Council refused to endorse the war, when the General Assembly passed resolutions condemning the war, when the Secretary General spoke out and condemned preemptive war, all of that, in my view, was the United Nations' finest moment, if you will. When that collapsed with the forced passage of a new resolution essentially endorsing the occupation, although still not legalizing the initial invasion, it was a huge collapse. And I think we've seen it go from bad to worse since that time. The UN has not agreed to go back in large numbers, and we should be grateful for that. But I think that the potential for the United Nations to return to that position of being part of the global mobilization for peace, as it was during those months, remains a huge task, and it's a very difficult one. The undermining of the United Nations in the long term is going to remain, I think, one of the most serious damning consequences of this war.
And that was Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and lead author of Paying the Price, a study of the human, economic, social, and environmental costs of the war in Iraq. The full report is available at the IPS website, ips-dc.org. This is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and on the web at wbai.org. As I said at the top of this sound file, the original audio for the first 30 minutes of today's show is lost, and this is a simulated replacement. After the Bennis interview, we were joined in the studio by Joe Garden and Mike Lowe of The Onion and Randy Ostro, whose day job is in the movie industry. They're the three authors of Citizen U, a patriotic manual for the patriotic American citizen, just published by the New Press. It seemed appropriate for a show broadcast just before the July 4th weekend, when, aside from taking up those tempting sales and consumer durables, we're also celebrating our foundational tax revolt. My first question was to wonder what, in a land of almost 300 million, all of us ordinary citizens could do to help keep us free and secure. We'll join in now at the tail end of Joe Garden's answer. The rest of the show, some 24 minutes worth, now follows as originally broadcast.
They need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and really dig in and you know, arm themselves, take care of business in their own backyards.
So this is kind of a development of the first Bush administration. We have now millions of points of light.
Yes.
Now, I have a neighbor I don't like. What can I do to investigate him for Al-Qaeda ties?
What's his last name?
Well, I can't say on the air.
Is it an Arabic-sounding last name?
Unfortunately not.
Is it a Jewish-sounding
yes,
last
yes,
name?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Have you checked to see whether he's circumcised? A lot of times, terrorists will pose as members of the Jewish faith in order to confound us in our search for them. It's very easy also to be fooled by people who are circumcised, because Arabic, many Muslim people are circumcised as well. So I was going to suggest that you actually contact his parents and find out whether he had a bar mitzvah.
Good idea. Good idea.
There's other methods you can use. You know, just your standard spying, your cup against the wall to give them a good listen, you know, monitoring the people that go in and out, monitoring their actions. You might want to take a day off of your own hectic schedule and follow his hectic schedule for a while just to see how it pans out.
Actually, he has a very laid-back schedule. I think he's unemployed.
Then he's plotting something.
That could be, yeah. So mysterious means of support. I always wondered how he pays the rent.
Does he have a computer?
I haven't been in his apartment in 15
because
years.
If you could set up one of those web cameras in each room of his apartment, maybe surreptitiously, although maybe you could convince him that the world is interested in what he's doing all the time, and then you could watch him all the time.
Now, what is the difference between members of Al-Qaeda and members of the Democratic Party?
It's quite slim, really.
Yeah, not a whole lot, to be honest. There's a few niggling details. One purports to believe in democratic elections, the other purport to not. But I don't know.
I think that the Al-Qaeda members are probably not registered voters, although that's also a hunch. I think that's how you could probably tell. We do have an application in to commandeer all of the voting records in the United States to check through them personally.
You'd be surprised at how difficult that actually is. It's
going to take a long time.
But with all these new voting machines, don't you have a way to see what people are doing and invalidate those votes you don't like?
Well, we're just going to go through the certain districts, nameless right now, and with cow magnets. An easy. I don't know if you're familiar with a cow magnet. I grew up on the farm. And a cow magnet is something you sort of feed a cow. It's a cylindrical magnet, and it sort of goes through their four stomachs and pulls out bits of metal that they've eaten and comes out their fundament. So, you know, it's a very powerful magnet. So, you know, a little bit of that around the voting machine, and, you know, you don't have to worry about your results whatsoever. You can't vote twice, so...
And, of course, all of us here at the Better Citizenship Bureau are very excited about some new voting machines that our campaign supporters have been developing. It's actually a new electronic voting machine that's combined with an ATM machine. For example, for every $10,000 that you have in your checking account, that means you get one vote to cast.
Cuts out the middleman, doesn't it?
Exactly.
As far as checking on the votes, we're pretty much going to leave that up to the people who devised the mechanism. Because we really do trust them. We think they're very trustworthy. They have said, they've told us they're trustworthy. And part of our approach is delegation. We believe in delegating responsibility to friends of ours who are extraordinarily wealthy.
I think, didn't Joe Stalin say something like, voting is fine, but it's who counts the votes that matters?
Yes. Stalin and Hitler said lots of interesting things that you can repeat endlessly.
Well, speaking of Stalin and Hitler, should we be worrying about threats to civil liberties? I mean, this manual you've written suggests all kinds of repressive and snooping activities.
Well, that depends upon what you mean by civil liberties. I've always been a little. It's always been a nebulous prospect to me. The whole notion of civil liberties. I mean, I'm civil to my friend Mike here. You know, and it is my very inalienable right to be civil to him. You know, where is the government stopping that? Not whatsoever.
Also, as long as you know what they're doing. Doing, and you're aware of it, and you approve of it, and you agree with it, I don't see any contradiction at all. I think, you know, if someone's going to spy on me to keep me safe, I am 100% in favor of that. And if somebody wants me to spy on everybody I come in contact with in order to keep everybody else safe, I'll do that too. That's my duty as a citizen.
Well, you hear people say now and then they're willing to sacrifice some degree of their freedom in order to have some increase in security. No. What do you think the proper trade-off is? Is there some appropriate ratio?
No freedom is being sacrificed at all.
But I think that, to be fair, I think that sometimes a small amount of people will have to sacrifice something for, you know, will have to sacrifice some, you know, liberties for the majority shareholders.
And, of course, you know, we have all sorts of new liberties, new freedoms that we're proposing in Citizen U. We have, you know, such things as the freedom from inconvenience, the freedom from discomfort, a freedom from workplace safety. Who needs those sorts of restrictions?
It's mighty inconvenient to take your shoes off when you want to board a plane, though.
Exactly. That's. But then again...
We tell you what kind of shoes to wear when you go on the plane and how rigorously to bathe your feet prior to going to the airport. Because actually, we've discovered that the biggest health threat to security guards at the gates of airports is the overpowering stench of Al-Qaeda members' feet when they take their shoes off to go through the metal detector.
Cleanliness, of course, being next to godliness, Christian godliness, I'm sure. So that brings up the question of how does God fit into the picture?
He was actually, like George Bush, we were his vessels. He was filling us up with his love and wisdom, and we were pouring it out back to the people in the form of this book, Citizen U.
Mike said that he actually vetted the book. I wasn't present when that happened. Mike, did God vet the book?
I was in touch with God personally, actually. Yes. George W. Bush and I do share a personal and profound connection.
What's his voice
with
like?
God's voice is a bit gravelly, actually. You know, he seems a little tired sometimes.
You once described it to me as similar to Broderick Crawford.
Right, yeah. But, you know, very...
And what about that odor of sanctity Catholics talk about? Did you get a whiff of that?
Mm.
Yes, that little frankincense. You know, I think there might have been a trace of that, actually, taking me back to St. Bernadette's Elementary. But, you know, God is a great guy. And, you know, I remember at some of our brainstorming meetings, I would look around and actually see a bit of the Pentecostal flame above my co-writers' heads.
It you didn't really, say that. You didn't tell me it about was, that. It Why was, didn't you point
well,
it out?
Well, there were three of you gathered in his name.
Would I have been able to see it if you had pointed it out?
Probably not your own. You might have been able to, you know.
Maybe it was the spirit.
I do face a significant handicap because I am of Jewish heritage.
All American, though.
Technically, I'm
divided
white.
Divided loyalties?
Technically, I am a white man.
Yeah, but aren't there a contract
but I am
divided
Jewish,
loyalties?
So oh, no. My loyalties aren't divided. No. No siree, Bob.
Once he made that call up to Jesus and Jesus answered, he was on the team.
Honorary member.
Yes.
You're listening to, that was just Joe Garden. And before that, Randy Ostro, also in the studio, Mike Lowe, the three authors of Citizen U, Helping Government Help Itself, the Ultimate Patriotic Handbook. And I neglected to play a little piece of appropriate music going into this segment, so let's do it now, and we'll be back after about a minute of this old classic from the Kinks. That was the Kinks from their mid-70s album. I can't remember what it was called. It was volume 2 of some concept thing, but it was Nobody Gives, was that one. Kill All the Left-Wing Intellectuals, which is, of course, I think...
That's a bit extreme.
Is it a bit extreme?
Yes, because we're going to need people to fill up the prisons that we intend to build in every community across the country. Sometimes more than one prison, depending on the
private sector
prisons that will employ the people in the towns and villages across America. Full employment is possible, but only if we keep our prisons full.
The prison economy is a stable economy, and stability is what we're looking for going into the next, I guess, 5 years. Not, I can't say millennium anymore, which is a big shame. That was supposed to be our big moment, but it never happened.
We've probably taken a baby step into the new millennium.
This is true. So taking us well into the next millennium, I suppose.
Yeah. Stability on the model of Iraq, say?
Very funny. I don't know if that's really an appropriate subject for levity, but now that you mention it, yes.
Ah.
Iraqi prisons could be more profitable, though. You know, I think that it's time to export, you know, such corporations as the Corrections Corporation of America, you know, the private prison industry that, you know, stopped looking at prison as a rehabilitative system and looked at it as a golden money-making opportunity. What we need to do is basically imprison just about all the Iraqis, I think, and start putting them to work.
Well, that's an awful lot of Iraqis. I'd say two-thirds would be I mean, because we can't possibly, we'd basically have to wall in the entire country of Iraq if we were
perhaps
to do that.
We could keep all Iraqis under the age of 7 out of prisons. I think those we could actually mold into good Americans.
But we wouldn't want to bring them here, though, you see, because we already have enough people here for our prisons. We don't need extra Iraqis here for our prisons. That's one of the reasons I'm very much opposed to the suggestions that they're going to move the facility at Guantanamo into Madison Square Garden. I oppose that.
Well, Manhattan is an ambiguous relation to American soil, very much like Guantanamo is.
It isn't the mainland, and so I'm always suspicious about every step I take in this cursed little island.
Speaking of Madison Square Garden, do you guys have any plans to welcome our leader to the city with the Republican Convention at the end of August?
I thought this was going to be a question about Prince.
We'll
probably see Prince, or at least protest Prince, at Madison Square Garden. But as far as our leader's concerned, absolutely. We'll be there with open arms.
What's Prince doing at Madison Square Garden? I missed this bit of news.
He'll be performing, I believe. Isn't he at Madison Square Garden?
I think he's going to be performing in a section of Madison Square Garden during the convention.
Unlike most Americans, we're actually quite thrilled that Prince stopped singing the dirty songs.
Right.
It's really nice to see that he found God.
And he's reclaimed his name?
Yes.
He has.
Now he's Prince Rogers Nelson and not the unpronounceable symbol. Now he can still sing Hot Thing, Barely 21, because that's of a consensual age, but he can no longer sing DSMR. No, DMS. Which one is it? I can't remember. Dance Music Romance.
Michael Powell's listening.
Oh, dear.
You can tell there are dark, dark corners in Joe's past.
As a Prince fan?
Perhaps.
As a fallible Christian man.
Well, we of course strayed from the subject of the Republican Convention. How do you feel about all those good Americans coming to town?
Well, really quite thrilled. You really don't see enough Texans in Manhattan. You know, that's going to be very exciting.
There's a cowboy, but he's generally not wearing many clothes.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, we're ecstatic that they're going to be coming.
We have all access passes. We can go in any room in the entire complex. If we wanted to walk into the bathroom while George Bush was having a bowel movement, we would be allowed to do that with the passes that we have.
And
we are very, very pleased and proud and excited.
We are connected.
We would probably slip a copy of Citizen U underneath the stall door. That's really the...
But doesn't he already have a copy?
I don't want to toot our horns.
Didn't you hand deliver a copy to 1600?
He not only has a copy, he has several cases that he keeps under the what they call the Clinton desk, where, you know, and he gives out copies of it to every single person who walks into the Oval Office.
Is that where he keeps Saddam's pistol too?
Yes,
I believe. Didn't he donate that to the arm? No, they donated to him. Excuse me. Yes,
yeah,
he keeps
it's his personal.
His personal pistol.
Medallion of triumph over his father as well as over Saddam Hussein, too.
I remember when, you know, we visited George Bush the other day and he showed us Saddam's beard that was shaved off. That was quite the trophy.
He could have washed it first.
But it wasn't even shaved off. They waxed it. And then they meticulously removed the wax and they reformed the beard into a beard shape.
Did you see that he was in court today and he was jabbing his finger around, jabbing and allowed to speak? I mean, what have they run out of gags, and have they run out of handcuffs?
This is what happens when you turn them over to Iraqi custody.
Exactly. What could these maniacs possibly? What could this maniac possibly have to say that would
that we would understand?
Exactly. There's nothing. He's the Iraqis apparently they've forgotten the lessons that we taught them, and
it's only been weeks. It's only been a matter of weeks. They've forgotten already.
But as Bill O'Reilly said, they're a bunch of ungrateful people, and we need to show them the final solution.
Wow.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, he actually used that phrase a couple of weeks ago.
Wow.
You know, he's a really, really progressive individual.
And
I think he's been
a model and inspiration to us all.
I'm afraid that, you know, that I think that might have been one of the few moments of actual coherence on Bill O'Reilly's part. I've heard him say some somewhat critical things about the president, like maybe the president should be addressing the people. He said that. I mean, I'm thinking to myself, you know, Bill O'Reilly, if you're so great, why don't you become the president? Our president has enough going on without having these yapping liberal dogs like you after at his heels all the time.
Our president doesn't have to speak to the people. He's speaking to God, you know? I mean,
directly.
Mm. As Bill O'Reilly said shortly after September 11th, the president has an uncomplicated view of the world, and so do I.
Mm. Bring on that final solution.
That's the good versus evil. That's the theocracy of evil that we talk about in the book. It is an uncomplicated good versus evil dichotomy. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to wonder about it. There's no soul searching involved. You can very, very easily divide every experience you have, every person you meet, everything you read, into good and evil. As Ann Coulter says in a guest appearance in our book, she'll never have to think about her values again.
Exactly. You know, in fact, I might like to just quiz our radio host, Doug Henwood, here for a moment. You know, tell me if you think this is good or evil. Assign good or evil to these two qualities, us or them. The Hummer, as compared to the Citroën, the Fiat, the Saab, the Volvo, the donkey cart, or walking?
Well, the Fiat is good because Italy was part of the coalition unwilling.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Would you rather have a juicy steak or goat's eyes? You know, these are the kinds of, you know, simple choices.
I'd go to that. Certainly go to
Do women look better in a cute miniskirt or a burqa?
I would go with the cute miniskirt, but doesn't that kind of challenge Christian theology to have women exposed in provocative ways?
You know, I've watched all of the biblical movies, and many of them have women who are practically nude in them. I don't know whether they were all covered up back then. I certainly would have been boring if they had been.
The Lord on the very cross was practically nude.
Yes, exactly. And some people think he was completely nude.
I'm speaking with the three authors of Citizen U, Mike Lowe, Joe Garden, and Randy Ostro, a helpful guide to how to be a good patriot, a good American, and help your government help itself in this time of scarce resources for public services. We need to get a good citizen volunteer corps helping us stay free and safe. And this is nominally an economic show, let's talk about, you've got some advice for small business in the book, there may be some struggling small business owners out in the audience. What would you say to them?
Well, the advice we offer is we give you very clear-cut ways that you can actually speed up progress and close your small business. Sometimes it's a very difficult thing to do. You don't really know where to begin. You know, we don't know how to better accommodate the Walmart or the Target that's coming into your neighborhood. So we just, you know, we'll have a few quick steps for how you can shut down your doors and get out of the way for the big guy.
Exactly. You know, I mean, many small businesses have that dollar bill taped to their cash register, the first dollar that they made. Be sure to grab that dollar bill before you close up for the last time. I mean, you can buy a soda with that kind of money.
There are a lot of other things that you can do when you're closing your business. For example, you can play out all of your credit. You go out, buy clothing, round trip first class air tickets to Hawaii, things like that on your corporate card, and then shut down the business. You can always cash those tickets in or even use them. You should go over to a successful friend's store and photograph all of his merchandise, and then turn photographs of it over to the insurance company and claim that it's all been stolen. That's one thing you can do.
You know, these are the kinds of tactics that, you know, we picked up from the big boys such as Kenny Lay and, you know, Dennis Kuznowski.
Almost indicted Kenneth Lay now, yes.
Well,
That's a sham. He's, believe me, almost indicted. Ha, ha, ha.
But now, also there's the other end of the spectrum. We've got some business advice from Walmart. The very opposite of the small business. Is Walmart a good model for a patriotic model for all of us?
Well, you can't really give any advice to Walmart. All you can do is just look at it and just weep with amazement.
Yeah.
What a glorious place that place is.
Yeah, they've particularly now that they've stopped the practice of putting their mass graves behind every store, sort of a sacrificial success token for themselves. I don't know. How would you gauge Walmart's success?
Well, Walmart is a place that pays their their contractors are filling the shelves of Walmart. They're paying their Chinese employees 31 cents an hour. things like that, you know, making toys all day in 20-hour shifts during peak season.
Beautiful. You know, where are they going to get a job like that anywhere else? Where are they going to have an employer who is so deeply interested in their security that they lock the doors at night and don't let them out?
Or rather, don't let bad people in.
That's the vigilance that we're hoping to see in all American businesses.
And the spirit of self-sacrifice.
Right. The competitive, to give you the competitive edge.
Except for the rich people who are getting their taxes cut. They don't need to any self-sacrifice.
They've done their work. You know, I don't see why this is there's this constant class elitism on the poor and middle class saying, hey, these rich people, they're not paying their fair share because they've done so much already to pay their share. What more do they need to do?
They've given us inspiration.
They serve as
the rich are demonized unfairly. You know, we don't murder our employees anymore. We don't take them out back and bury them where nobody can find them. Walmart stopped doing that years ago. You will not find a mass grave within 60 yards of any Walmart in this country, I dare say.
Now we just let slow-growing liver tumors do the work, right?
Yes.
Now we're just about out of time, but I have two personnel questions here. First of all, why do women find Donald Rumsfeld so hot?
Boy, we could spend a few hours on that.
Partially, there's biological reasons, there's visual reasons, there's sociological reasons. I've been in the presence of Donald Rumsfeld. I'll tell you, my nostrils flare.
Donald Rumsfeld is the Ubermensch. He is a mythical warrior. His ability to overcome other men in wrestling bouts, it's a very erotic thing for most women and men. You know, there's a very erotic component to
manly power. There's nothing wrong with that.
I always feel inferior when I see a picture of him.
Yeah, the statistics don't lie. I mean, 89% of Republican women and 72% of Republican men regularly entertain erotic fantasies about Donald Rumsfeld.
He's Thor and Zeus all rolled into one.
Wow.
That's right.
Wow, yeah. And final question, why is Karl Rove known as Turd Blossom?
I think that's a personal matter between our
I don't mind talking about it. I don't mind talking about it at all. He has a problem cleaning himself up after going to the bathroom.
I don't know that that's appropriate to let other people know, Rand.
One of the things that we are pioneering with this book is complete openness, and I think that there aren't any boundaries.
Complete freedom.
Complete freedom. Complete openness. Truth.
And that's a key to his political strategy, too.
That's true. That's very true.
All right, we have to bring it to a close, but anybody in the audience who wants more can pick up a copy of Citizen U, Helping Your Government Help Itself, just out from the New Press. Thanks to Mike Lowe, Joe Garden, and Randy Ostro, the authors.
And if I can make one note as well, we also have a website for all patriotic Americans to go to, and that is simply www.citizenu.com.
Citizenu.com. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with another reminder of why we love this country so. It's the church, the liquor store, and the auto repair shop that the Beacons sing about.